Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. I love just about everything nature has to offer, but one of my personal favorite visitors to our Northern California yard are hummingbirds. From the distinctive sounds made by their wings that flap at rates up to 70 times per second, and their high-energy metabolisms that can cause their heart rates to range from 50 to 1,200 beats per minute, hummers are nature's wonder machines. To learn more about these amazing creatures, we're joined by Christopher Clark. Chris is the principal investigator for the Animal Aeroacoustics Lab at the University of California, Riverside, and he's a world-class expert on the tiniest of birds. He joins us now to talk about them. Christopher Clark, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Start out by telling us about your journey. How did you first get interested in hummingbirds to the point where, you know, this has become something you do as a researcher at UC Riverside?
Well, my whole life I was interested in science and the natural world. And I grew up in Seattle, and I remember sitting on the front porch of my parents' house and noticing a bird on a telephone wire and getting really curious. Well, what is that? And I went and found my parents' binoculars and I found their bird book. And it took, because I didn't know what I was doing, it took me a long time. It took me an hour to figure out that that red bird over there was a house finch, which for any of your audience that are bird watchers will know house finches are pretty common and not really a bird that people now get excited over. But when you're, you know, when it's your spark bird, when you're brand new at something, you know, everything is interesting. Then the hummingbirds that are in Seattle, Anna's hummingbirds, which are now there year round. This was another species that I quickly learned to identify and was interested in as a high school student. Fast forward a few years, I did my undergraduate at Washington State University and kind of knew that I wanted to be a scientist and I really liked birds. And so studying birds for my, I wanted to get a PhD and studying birds for my PhD was kind of the obvious thing to do. And right around the time that I was accepted to the University of Texas at Austin, my grandmother died. And we, on driving back from the funeral, we stopped off at a diner in Idaho. And as we sat there at the window, the diner had a hummingbird feeder set up. And these hummingbirds are flying to the feeder, you know, a good 6 inches away from my face. And I looked at them and I thought to myself, wow, hummingbirds are really cool. And they'd be easy to catch. And so I kind of just all of a sudden in that moment decided that I wanted to study hummingbirds. And so early in my PhD, I was studying hummingbird flight and hummingbird flight mechanics. Initially, I had no interest in the sounds that they make, but almost sort of by accident, partway through my PhD, I figured out that Anna's hummingbirds make these really loud sounds with their tail feathers during a courtship display. And so that finding, once I'd actually like solidly notched that, yes, that really is what's going on, that deflected my research trajectory. And so now in the 15 or so years since then, almost all the work that I've done has been about sound in one way or another. And often it's been at the intersection of how do hummingbirds fly? How do they perform courtship displays? And what role do sounds play in those courtship displays?
Well, let's go to do a little hummingbirds 101, if you will, because they are such fascinating creatures. I was thinking about this earlier today, and I have to say that I can't think of a more interesting creature on Earth than hummingbirds. What's your take on that?
Yeah, people love hummingbirds. I absolutely agree that for various reasons, they capture the imagination of the public. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that they tend to be really bold. They tend to fly right up to you in ways that a lot of other birds are more afraid of humans than hummingbirds are. Another is that they are brightly colored. And, you know, especially an adult male of some species, the colors on them can just be absolutely amazing and dazzling. And a third feature is that they hover. They fly differently than other birds. And there's, you know, kind of in the psyche, people wish they could fly or wish they had the ability to fly. And hummingbirds are masters of the air. They are able to fly at, you know, basically they can hover in place. They can fly at really slow speeds. And they can also accelerate up to pretty high speeds when they fly. And so, well, okay. And actually another one, come to think of it, is that hummingbirds are often associated with flowers. You know, the hummingbirds are brightly colored, but flowers that they visit are also brightly colored. And so when people think of gardens and what do we like to have in gardens and what beautiful things do we have in gardens? Well, this idea that hummingbirds go with the flowers that you might plant in a garden, they just kind of have become this quintessential garden species for people that live in a part of the world that have them. So I think all those reasons kind of mixed together are what caused the public to really love hummingbirds.
Well, they're my personal favorite, so That's all I have to say about that. I just adore them, and that's why I'm so fascinated to talk to you about them. What exactly are hummingbirds in the grand picture of birds?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways to answer that question. So first is that if you take, there's about 10,000 species of living bird right now, and half of them are this group called the perching birds. Hummingbirds are not perching birds. So within this, within the kind of the other quote unquote half of birds, there's a number of deep lineages. One is this lineage called Strisores. And the base of Strisores are all nocturnal birds. So one of the colloquial names for the group are the night birds. But the funny thing is that hummingbirds are nested inside of Strisores. No hummingbird is nocturnal. Every single living hummingbird is a daytime bird. But they have a number of features about them that are left over from this nocturnal ancestry. So the other group of birds that are inside Strisores but are daytime are the swifts. And basically, you can think of swifts as being, they're amazing at flying, but they're stuck in high gear. They are the sports car of the bird world. No swift can fly slowly. All of them fly really fast, flying around, catching insects. And then hummingbirds, the sister group to swifts, instead of being masters at high-speed flight, hummingbirds are masters they're like helicopters. They're able to fly, they're able to hover, but they're also able to fly at intermediate speeds. So the other thing about this group Strisores is that most of the species in it eat insects. So the Strisores includes nighthawks, nightjars, owlet nightjars, potus, frogmouths, and then this weird bird called the oilbird. Oilbirds don't eat insects, but all of those other groups eat insects, as do swifts. And so hummingbirds are basically unique within this group. They also eat insects for their nutrition, but they have to drink nectar to get their calories. So basically, hummingbirds have evolved out of this group of birds that are both nocturnal and primarily insectivorous. And so it's weird and amazing that they've evolved this unique mode of flight and evolved to be able to drink nectar when also evolved to be daytime birds when their ancestors were none of those things.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How many species of hummingbirds are there in the world?
Yeah, they're a very diverse group. It is more than 350 species. I didn't check the taxonomy this morning to know the exact number today, but the number of species that are currently recognized continues to grow, and that's because scientists are still figuring out, in some cases, whether things that have been lumped together into a single species, are they really one species or are they two? So I played a small role in one split several years ago. This bird that we originally thought was one species in the Bahamas actually got split into two. So as splits continue, where will we stop? I don't actually know. The number will probably be more than 400 species. But you know, that's the nature of the splits, is you don't know about them until after they've occurred. And then related to that, another question is, are there any undescribed species of hummingbird in the world? That's also impossible to know. There have been a handful of species described from parts of South America in the last couple of decades. There was a species that was described a couple of years ago from a remote mountain in Ecuador. And the other country that is underexplored is Colombia. Parts of Colombia have been inaccessible to scientists due to the FARC and the guerrillas in Colombia. And so it does remain possible that there could be a small number of species that have not been already discovered by scientists.
And all of the hummingbirds are exclusively found in the Americas, is that right?
Yes, all living hummingbirds are found in North, Central, and South America, including the Caribbean. And there's an aspect of that which is really weird, which is that there are fossil hummingbirds from Europe. And that implies a couple things. And so the fossil hummingbirds are old. They don't fall within crown hummingbirds. They are instead stem hummingbirds. They're, I think, from 20 or 25 million years ago. But basically, because there's fossils there, but there are no living hummingbirds in Europe, that implies that hummingbirds used to live there and they went extinct. And so if you look across the world, there are some other groups of birds that also drink nectar. This group of perching birds called the sunbirds, especially. Sunbirds are found in Africa and also Southern Asia. And because they're not found in the same places as hummingbirds, but they're very hummingbird-like in their habits, what we don't know is that if you put up, you know, a sunbird species versus a hummingbird species, would one outcompete the other? We don't have any direct tests of that, but I kind of think the hummingbirds would manage to outcompete the sunbirds, that hummingbirds are just so excellent at drinking nectar. And so these old hummingbird populations that have gone extinct that used to live in Europe, they would have been there at the same time that sunbirds would have been in Europe and in Africa. And so the fact that the hummingbirds went extinct and the sunbirds didn't, it's curious. It doesn't fully make sense.
Yeah, that's strange. And of course, they're called hummingbirds because of the sound they make with their wing beats. The humming sound, just so fascinating and cool to hear close up. I'm interested in the sound that they make, and I'm wondering, could you play something for us? Could you suggest something we could listen to where we could hear that sound?
Sure. I study their sound, so I have a number of different recordings.
Let's listen to the humming sound from their wings.
When you listen to the humming of the wings, what's happening is that the bird is flapping its wings at about 50 times per second, and that means that there's 50 pulses of sound coming off the wings in two of the three cardinal directions, and then about 100 pulses per second in the third direction. And that's high enough frequency that our ears can hear it. We hear down to about 20 hertz. Most birds flap their wings more slowly than 20, and so we don't actually hear their wing beats as sound. But because hummingbirds are small, they therefore have a high wing beat frequency, and therefore it's high enough for us to hear. And what's happening when you hear their wing beat is that you're hearing both sound at the bass frequency that they're flapping their wings. So, for example, at 50 hertz, but you're also hearing the harmonics. So the second harmonic of 50 hertz would be 100. It's literally just twice the fundamental frequency. The third harmonic, it would be 150 hertz. The fourth harmonic would be about 200 hertz, and so on. And because we hear higher frequencies better than we hear low frequencies, those harmonics are really salient to our ears. So when you're listening to the humming of a hummingbird's wings, you're hearing kind of all of those sounds at once. So basically, the humming sound that hummingbirds are making, it's a direct response to the aerodynamic force that the wings are producing. So basically, I know this is on the radio, so you can't see me, but I'm busy pantomiming a hummingbird's wing moving with my hand right now. As the wing is flapping, it's got this aerodynamic force vector that points off of it. So the sound is kind of the equal opposite reaction to that force vector. And so how big the vector is depends on which direction you are around the bird. What this means for the sound is that exactly what the sound sounds like is different in different directions.
Let's talk about the mechanics of their flight, because most birds, they're only generating the lift on the downstroke of their wing beats, whereas hummingbirds are always getting lift. And could you just describe how that works? Because like most birds, they fold their wings on the upstroke.
Yeah.
And hummingbirds don't do that. Tell us about how they fly and how different that is.
Yeah. So birds have two parts of their wing. They have the arm part of the wing and the hand part of the wing. So the hand part of the wing is the feathers that come off of the finger bones. And when they fold their wing, basically what they're doing is they're tucking their fingers back, and that causes the primary feathers, which are the outer feathers that come off of the hand part of the wing, to kind of fold on themselves. Normal birds, when they fly, they're doing some of that folding during the upstroke. Hummingbirds do almost none of it. So you can think of a hummingbird wing, it's basically like a paddle. Not exactly, because the wing does still change shape, but it's not being folded during the upstroke. And so basically, when a hummingbird is hovering, the downstroke is still producing more than half the total lift. But as you said, it's not producing 100% of the lift. It's only producing somewhere between half to two-thirds of the total lift. And then when at the bottom of the downstroke, when the wing turns over, and now the bird uses it as a paddle a second time, the upstroke produces about a third of the lift. And so this is one of the tricks that lets them hover. So in a normal bird, if they're going flap, 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 and they flap their wings five times, they're only getting to produce lift off the downstroke, but hummingbirds are producing lift on both the downstroke and the upstroke. Now, what we were just describing is what they do when they hover, and of course, hovering is what hummingbirds are famous for. If you put a hummingbird in a wind tunnel and have it fly at high speeds, what happens is they stop producing lift on the upstroke, and the upstroke becomes inactive, just like in other birds, and instead they shift over to producing all of their lift on the downstroke.
So that's when they're like propelling themselves forward at high speed.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. So basically their flight design is that they fly very similarly to other birds at high speeds, but they switch into this other mode gradually. So it's not like a snap that all of a sudden they're doing it, but as they slow down, they transition over to producing a lot of lift.
They are the smallest birds on Earth, right? Or the hummers, is correct?
Yeah. So other birds, yeah, basically about half of all hummingbird species are 4 grams or less. And if you look at other groups of birds, 4 grams is about the lower size limit. So there's a couple, there's a few passerine birds that get down to 4 grams. I think there's a toady that's 5 grams. Something about hummingbirds lets them get smaller than 4 grams. And so the very smallest bird is the bee hummingbird of Cuba, where males of that species weigh about 1.7 grams. And this is, like, if you think of a large bumblebee, the Cuban bee hummingbird is the size of a large bumblebee.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the lives of hummingbirds with our guest, Associate Professor of Evolution Ecology and Organismal Biology at UC Riverside. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Our guest is Dr. Christopher Clark. He's an associate professor of biology at UC Riverside and the principal investigator for their animal aeroacoustics lab. And we're talking about one of nature's most fascinating creatures, hummingbirds. Well, let's talk about another fascinating thing about hummingbirds, is they really live on the edge in terms of energy. They have to expend a lot of energy in their flight and to collect nectar. And so that means they have to have this amazing metabolism. Talk a bit about, you know, how they precariously live on the edge in terms of energy.
Yeah, so they are small. And so one of the curious things about physiology is that physiological processes, they run faster the smaller you are. And so they have a high metabolism and they burn through a lot of energy relative to their body size. And so a typical hummingbird, like a typical Anna's hummingbird, which is a species that we have here in California, they need to eat about 7 calories of nectar per day. And if you scale that up to a person, 7 calories compared to for human, that's not very many calories. That's, you get that in one bite of food. But relative to the size of the bird, that's a huge amount of sugar. So that's almost 2 grams of sugar. And the Anna's hummingbird is a species that an adult will weigh about 4.5 grams. So imagine a human, rather, needing to consume half your body weight in sugar every day just to get enough calories to survive. I don't have the number in front of me. I once did the calculation of how many cans of Coke would a human have to drink if we had the same metabolism as a human. And I want to say the number was in the hundreds. But I mean, that's just, you look at how much sugar is there in a Coke, and then you figure that a person is eating about 40% of their weight in pure sucrose every day. Whoa. Yeah, you get hundreds of cans of Coke. And that's basically what hummingbirds are doing to survive. And there are times when they can starve to death really quickly. So just like other animals, they will put on fat when they need to. And especially some species migrate long distances. We don't know exactly how far they can go when they migrate, but we do know that ruby-throated hummingbirds will fly across the Gulf of Mexico. They will take off from Louisiana, but they've been seen from oil platforms and other things in the Gulf, and they land in the Yucatan, which is about 500 miles away. We know from wind tunnel studies that they can fly at 25 miles per hour pretty comfortably. And so if you 500 miles, 25 miles per hour, that's 20 hours or so, like a full day of flying to cross the Gulf of Mexico. So what they do this is they gain a whole bunch of fat. So a ruby-throated hummingbird might weigh 3.5 grams. I think there are a few records of them fattening up to 6 grams, and certainly lots of records of them fattening up to 5 grams in order to fuel this journey. So basically what they will do when they have to go a long time without eating is they will fatten up. But the other thing about this that is just completely amazing, I mean, imagine, you know, a person that weighs 100 pounds fattening up to 160 pounds over the course of a couple of weeks, and then in one go, you know, one bout of exercise, one ultra marathon or something like that, burning all 60 pounds of fat and coming back down to 100 pounds. Like, it is just absolutely amazing how fast energy turns over in their bodies.
That is amazing. And then just during the day and night for a hummingbird, it's fascinating. Their metabolisms are really interesting because they have a really rapid heart rate, as I understand it, while they're flying. And then that, you know, drops down when they're perched. And then at night, they go into a state called torpor. So I'm wondering if you talk to us a bit about those different states and what kind of heart rates they have that enables them to do all this in the course of a day. Because as you said, they are not nocturnal.
Yeah. So torpor, I mean, a minute ago, we were talking about how hummingbirds are smaller than other bird species. We haven't really figured out physiologically what is it that lets hummingbirds reach smaller body sizes than any other group of birds. But my gut feeling or my guess is that it's related to torpor and this flexibility in their metabolism. So basically, normally their metabolic rate is really high. Normally they've got a high heart rate, as you just said. Normally they're breathing fast and burning through a lot of oxygen. And so torpor is a mechanism for them to save energy. So what this is, you know, if you let your body temperature drop, I'm assuming the audience here is human. If a human lets their body temperature drop by more than a few degrees, it quickly gets really dangerous because a person goes into hypothermia. And in humans, you know, yes, there are stories of people, you know, falling into a frozen lake and surviving for a long time with a reduced body temperature. But basically, once that happens, the person needs to be rescued and has to be artificially warmed up. Hummingbirds do this naturally. So torpor is where they let their body temperature fall, and this saves them energy. It saves them a lot of energy. And so basically, for them to drop their body temperature, they have to be in a place that's cool. And what they're doing is their internal thermometer or their internal fire, so to speak, is saying, okay, I'm going to let go of control of the body temperature and let the body temperature fall. As their body temperature falls, the amount of energy that they burn plummets. And so a hummingbird that's having a problem getting enough food to eat, if they go into torpor, they can basically spend the night spending only a tiny fraction of the total amount of energy that they would need to burn if they were trying to stay warm. Then what happens is that when dawn is approaching, they somehow know what time it is. Even so, the genes that are related to or physiological processes that are related to keeping track of what time it is are likely to be temperature sensitive. And so somehow hummingbirds have broken this temperature sensitivity of their timing genes.
Their circadian rhythms?
Well, the circadian rhythm is part of it. Like basically all organisms have ways of telling time. So the circadian rhythm is one part of it. We haven't fully worked out what the genes are that keep track of time. But anyway, the point is that these genes and their action is almost certainly going to normally be temperature sensitive. So in other words, if a human gets really cold, their sense of time might get altered just as a part of being in the altered mental state of having hypothermia. Somehow hummingbirds can let themselves go into torpor and they still know what time it is. And what will happen is that as dawn is approaching, they start to warm up. And we know from studies where people have pointed thermal cameras at the birds, it's not that they're waiting for dawn and light and starting to warm up only after there's light. They start to warm up, you know, a good half hour or so before dawn arrives. And so what that means is that by the time it's actually light enough to see, they've also warmed up and can fly. So torpor has some downsides. The biggest one is that when they're in torpor, they are completely helpless. If a snake or some other predator finds them and they're in torpor, they have no way to run away. They are completely helpless and defenseless. And so we don't know how often they actually use torpor in nature. I have a laboratory at UC Riverside. I have captive hummingbirds. We haven't actually studied torpor in my lab, but occasionally I've had birds go into torpor. But I don't think it happens every night when the birds have plenty of food to eat. So one hypothesis is that they save torpor for emergencies. So like during a hummingbird's day, normally they will eat a whole lot of food right before bedtime in order to have the energy to survive the night. If they, for some reason, miss that meal, they then have torpor as a possible energy saving mechanism to deal with this food emergency that they've just had. Another idea is that when they're migrating, which is basically migration requires a huge amount of energy because they're going to fly a long distance. They might use torpor every night when they're migrating as a way to save energy in order specifically to have as many calories as possible to save as fat to be able to fly the next leg of their journey. And so these two hypotheses that it's sometimes used routinely or it's just used in emergencies, we have data from laboratory studies, but we don't have data from wild birds to know how often they actually use it in the wild. And that's because sleeping hummingbirds or torpid hummingbirds are really hard to find in the wild.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. And like you said, they would be so vulnerable when they're in that state at night. Let's talk about how they actually feed, because that's really interesting to watch if you ever go up to a feeder, especially, you know, the feeders that I have are just clear glass and just the sugar water with no food coloring in it. It's interesting to watch, you know, how they go about feeding. Talk about the anatomical tools they have to get at nectar and flowers.
Yeah, so one misnomer is that they suck the nectar. And actually, some recent research from a friend of mine, Alejandro Rico Guevara at the University of Washington, he's the one that specifically has done research on how they drink. So, of course, all hummingbirds have a long bill. There's a few species in South America that the bill is not particularly long. And then you get, at the other extreme, you get sword-billed hummingbird. This is a hummingbird with a bill that's 6 inches long. Like, the bill is longer than its body. Inside the bill is a tongue. And so the first part of this is that the bill itself matches the shape of the flowers that the birds visit. So the sword-billed hummingbird, this hummingbird with a 6-inch bill, they visit Passiflora flowers where the flower itself has a corolla that's 6 inches long. And so basically the idea is that the flower is holding the nectar deep inside of it where only a really long-billed hummingbird can reach. Also in the tropics, there's a number of species that have really curved bills. The sickle-bill hummingbird is kind of the winner at this one. Their bill has got a, you know, curvature of 30 or 40% of a circle. And the flowers they visit also are really curved. So a straight-billed hummingbird couldn't fit its bill inside of these curved flowers, but the sickle-billed hummingbird can. So we start off with this match where species with long bills or curved bills visit flowers that have long corollas or curved corollas. And then the species we have, for example, in California or other parts of North America, the bill is somewhat long and they're reaching inside of flowers that also have corollas that more or less match the shape. Okay, so once the bird has inserted its bill into the flower, what it's trying to do is to get the tip of its bill as close to the nectar source as possible. Then what it does is it sticks out its tongue, and the tip of the bill is flexible. So they don't have to open their entire bill. They can open just the tip of their bill, just enough for the tongue to snake out. And the tip of the tongue is made out of keratin. Keratin is the same material that feathers or hair or your fingernails are made out of. So in other words, their tongue is pretty different from ours. And the tongue, when it comes out of the tip of the bill, it's bifurcated. It's got two sides. And both of them are basically this keratin. It's got a rod running down the side and then a bunch of filaments. That the filaments, when they go into the nectar, they open up. And then when the bird starts to retract its tongue out of the nectar, these filaments kind of wrap around the nectar, trapping it. And so when the bird retracts its tongue into its bill, each of the two sides of the tongue, these two tubes, each have trapped a few microliters of nectar. So now what happens is the bird has retracted its tongue into its bill. Now it needs to get the nectar off of its tongue. And so what it does is it then pushes its tongue back out, but there are a couple little prongs that are inside the bill that basically act like a scraper, that when the bird is pushing its tongue back out, back into the flower, the scraper is scraping the nectar off the tongue and into the inside of the bill. And then another part of the tongue that's further down has these two little flaps. And as the bird brings its tongue back in on the next cycle, these two flaps are pushing the nectar down the bill towards the mouth. So basically, the bird is sticking its tongue, it's cycling its tongue in and out, in and out. And it takes about three or so of these cycles for the nectar to go from the tip of the bill to the tip of the beak, and then from the tip of the beak down into the mouth of the bird. And so when you're watching a bird feed, either at a bird feeder or at a flower, if it's a clear feeder, like you mentioned, you can see the tip of the tongue coming in and out of the tongue into the nectar. And the other thing that you will always see is the feathers at the base of the mouth also moving. And that's the buccal cavity, the mouth itself, cycling the nectar as it comes into the mouth. And then the final thing that you see sometimes, but not always, is that the feathers on the top of the head will move also. So what's going on there is that, you know, a hummingbird has a long bill and a long tongue, and to run a long tongue, you need a long muscle. And so the muscles that run the tongue, instead of attaching at the base of the mouth, the way they do in most animals like you or me or you know, dogs or other birds, those muscles instead wrap around the skull, and they insert at the top of the skull, right at the top of the beak. And so basically, the bird is flexing the muscles that are in the top of its head in order to cycle the tongue in and out. And so sometimes you'll see the feathers on the top of the head moving in response to those muscles cycling. This is similar to, like, in your arms, the muscles that control your fingers are actually in your forearms. And there's, you know, so the muscles contracting in one part of your body to cause motion in a nearby a portion of your anatomy. So the same thing is happening with the birds, except in this case, the muscles are on the top of the head that are then wrapping around the skull to attach to the tongue.
And then, of course, they're attracted to flowers. Evolution has created this marvelous relationship between flowers and insects and hummingbirds. And it's interesting to watch what they're attracted to. Are they solely attracted to color? They don't smell, do they?
They do have a little bit of a sense of smell, but the flowers they visit tend to not produce any smell. So the relationship with flowers seems to be an entirely visual one. And in general, they are attracted to bright colors. A lot of hummingbird pollinated plants have red flowers. And so that means that they quickly learn to associate red with a possible food source. But there are lots of places where the flowers can be other colors, but especially like oranges or yellows or blues are other common colors. Most of the flowers they visit, it's the flower itself that's colorful, but there's a plant, I'm forgetting its name right now, but there's a plant in the tropics where the flower itself is green and really inconspicuous, but when there's nectar inside of it, a spot on the plant nearby turns red, and the hummingbirds have learned to associate, if there's red over there, that means this right here will have nectar in it. And that's a connection that insects have a harder time making. So it seems that what's going on there is the plant is trying to hide the fact that it has nectar from insects, but, you know, surreptitiously advertised to birds that, hey, come over here, I've got something for you.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool. It's interesting. I have some rufous hummingbirds are migrating through my yard right now. And whereas the resident Anna's hummingbirds, they know where the feeders are and where the flowers are. But I was watching a couple of these rufous hummingbirds. They were attracted to these little red plastic tabs on a pop-up canopy tent. And they kept going to those red plastic tabs thinking, oh, you know, this looks good. And then they'd realize, oh, no, nothing happening here.
Yeah, the way to think about it is that, you know, no flower lives forever. And hummingbirds need to feed 365 days of the year. Like, that they're not hibernating for part of the year the way that, you know, a poor will might or bats might. And so, you know, in some places the birds might visit flowers that have lots of nectar and only need to visit a couple hundred flowers in a day. But in North America, most of the flowers they visit, each individual flower has only a small amount of nectar in it. And a hummingbird might need to visit 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000 flowers in a day in order to meet its energy needs. And so, you know, a typical hummingbird pollinated flower might open one day, have nectar for a couple of days, and then the flower senesces. It's been pollinated and it moves on with its life cycle. And so if a hummingbird is going to visit 4,000 flowers in a day, and every day a bunch of those flowers are not there anymore, it needs to be constantly looking for new sources of food. And so, especially if it's small, they're attracted to any sort of bright color that might be a flower. Kind of a classic one is that when people do field work, it's really common to have this flagging tape. And flagging tape is usually brightly colored, so people will notice it. I've been doing field work where somebody tied up some flagging tape, and in the knot there was a little hole, and hummingbird after hummingbird would come up and stick its beak into that hole to try to see if there was any nectar inside.
Wow.
Or another example of this... I think this was back in the 80s, there was a company that was making electric fences that the insulators that the electric fence wire had a little hole in it. And so hummingbirds would land on the electric fence and stick beak into the bill and then get electrocuted as a result. And so this company quickly found that in certain spots, there were piles of dead hummingbirds underneath the electric fence because the birds were investigating the insulators to see if they were if there was a flower. In that particular case, as soon as it became clear what was going on, they changed the design of the insulator. So that problem went away about as quickly as it arose. But hummingbirds are kind of constantly on the lookout for things that might be food. And that means that they will come and investigate small objects that are red or any other bright color.
Well, and speaking of colors, hummingbirds can be incredibly colorful and they have these strikingly iridescent colors. What produces that?
Yeah, so we're still figuring out all of the ways that they produce the colors that they have. So iridescence is where all the light gets reflected in a direction that depends both on the orientation of the structure, but also the source of light. And so hummingbirds, the iridescent colors they have on them, from some angles, they'll look black or really dark. And then from other angles, they'll be a brilliant color. And what's going on there is that the feathers, the feather microstructure and the feather nanostructure is creating these colors. So basically, inside the barbules of the feathers, the barbules being one of the, like, you can think of a feather, it's got a central shaft, and then it's got barbs that come off the central shaft, and then off the barbs are barbules, and the barbules are kind of what make up the surface of the feather. Inside the barbules, the material of the feather, it's a combination of keratin. So keratin is a protein. It's, you know, it's what makes up your hair or your fingernails. Then there are these little organelles called melanosomes. And the third thing that's in there is air. And melanosomes, keratin, and air each have a different refractive index. And what this means is that light passes through each of these three materials differently. And when light comes to an interface in between two of those three materials, some of the light will reflect. And so basically what happens is that inside the feather, there are layers of each of these materials. And different feathers, the layers are different in their details. But basically, it's the thickness of the layers that then affects what wavelength of light gets reflected back out. And so the different colors that you get in hummingbirds on their gorgets or other iridescent parts of their plumage, those are created by differences in these in the dimensions of these layers of these three materials. Then a lot of hummingbirds have green on them. This is also produced as a structural color, but it's not iridescent in the sense that the light is reflected in all directions. And that's one that I, off the top of my head, I actually don't know what the nanostructure is that creates the green colors they have on their back. But it's not a pigment, as far as we know. The other bird species can have green colors that are caused by pigments, especially like the eggs of emus or the green in parrots. But in hummingbirds, the green feathers they have are created in a way that's similar to how they create their iridescent colors.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the lives of hummingbirds with UC Riverside Associate Professor of Biology, Christopher Clark. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with Chris Clark, principal investigator for the UC Riverside Animal Aeroacoustics Lab and an expert on hummingbirds. Okay, let's talk a bit about the sounds they make, because that's something you're particularly interested in, the acoustics. It's really fun. In fact, this morning I woke up, and it wasn't quite light yet, but I could hear the hummingbirds out in my yard starting to, you know, make vocalizations and chase each other around. Talk about the sounds that hummingbirds make.
Yeah, so hummingbirds are both, just as we were talking about a minute ago, they're highly visual species, but they're also highly acoustic. And they make sounds at least three different ways. So all species, at least as far as I know, all species produce vocalizations. So just like I'm talking into the microphone right now, and it's my voice box, it's my larynx and my throat that's generating the sounds, and then it's my mouth that's modifying the sounds. Hummingbirds do the same thing. The organ they have in their throat is called the syrinx. It's a slightly different organ than the larynx, but the way it works is basically the same, that the vibrations start inside the respiratory passages of the bird, and then they pass out. In the case of in a lot of birds, the bill will modify the sound, but hummingbirds will often vocalize with their bill shut. So they don't modify their sounds with their beak in the same way that some other birds do. But the sounds that I study, instead of being made vocally, they're made non-vocally. They're made with the wings and tail feathers. So a bit ago in the interview, we were talking about the humming sound that hummingbird wings make. What seems to happen is that when animals move, and especially when they move fast, there's a tendency for them to produce accidental or what we call adventitious sounds just as a part of their motion. So if we think about the humming of the hummingbird's wings, in courtship displays especially, they tend to increase their wing beat frequency. And so that means the pitch of the humming sound, it goes up when they're performing a courtship display. And then what has happened is that a whole bunch of species have modified the humming sound to add additional sounds on top of it. So one of the sound recordings that I sent to you guys earlier was ruby-throated hummingbird.
Can we play that now?
Yeah.
Okay, what did we just hear there?
Yeah, so that's a ruby-throated hummingbird that I recorded in Connecticut a number of years ago. And what's going on is that's a male performing a courtship display for a female, and that clicking sound, that click, 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 he's making that clicking sound with his wings every time he turns around. So what he's doing is he's basically flying back and forth, click, 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 and each time he turns in this display, his wings are making that clicking sound. I don't actually remember... Yeah, that species, in other species, they have like specially shaped wing feathers that produce the sound. In ruby-throated hummingbird, I'm not sure which wing feathers it is that makes the sound, but in other hummingbird species that we have in North America, such as Rufous hummingbird or Allen's hummingbird, it's the outer wing feather that has this little notch in it that then makes the feather, as they're flapping their wings, the feather briefly flutters at high frequency, and that high frequency is what we actually hear as this added sound. So in ruby-throated hummingbird, that sound that you just heard, that's mainly made during their courtship displays. But in some of the species, such as broad-tailed hummingbird or rufous hummingbird, when the males are flying around, this noisemaker in their wings is making sound at all times. And so as they fly around, it's called a wing trill. You can simply hear them as they're buzzing around doing their thing.
Okay, one of my favorite hummingbirds is one that's common here in Northern California, and you mentioned it earlier, is the Anna's hummingbird. And they do these spectacular dives in my backyard where they'll climb high elevation, you know, up above the big pine tree or a redwood tree in our yard, and then they just dive at these tremendous rates. What's going on there in it? And do you have some sounds from that?
Yeah, so here's the sound of the dive sound that they make when they dive. Okay, so there were two parts to that sound. The first part was kind of quiet. The first part was a faint wing trill as the bird was descending. And then at the end of the sound recording, there was this beep or chirp sound that they make. So the first part, the faint part of the sound, the trill, is made by the wings. What's happening in the dive is they're using gravity to go a lot faster than they can go in level flight. And so when they're doing the dive, they're going upwards of 50 or 60 miles per hour as they approach the bottom of the dive. And so their wings are making additional sound, although again, not very loud sound. Then right as they pass over the female or over the microphone, the male abruptly spreads his tail, and it's his outer tail feathers that make that loud beep sound. So I got high-speed videos of them diving. Basically, they hold their tail spread for about 1/20th of a second, and the sound they produce is made for the same amount of time. And so what's going on is the back edge of the outer tail feather is fluttering at about 4 kilohertz. And then what's happening is that the neighboring feather, so the outer feather is called R5, the neighboring feather, R4, is amplifying the sound that's produced by R5. And so kind of the total sound that you hear, one of the reasons why it's so loud is there's an aerodynamic interaction between the outer tail feather and the second outermost tail feather.
Oh, that's cool. Could we hear that one more time? Oh, yeah, that's amazing. Okay, why are they doing this? Why are they diving? Is this a courtship thing? Why are they diving like that? Because I find it just amazing to watch them do these aerial displays.
Yeah, it has to be, in some way, it's a courtship display because the males do it and the females don't. The males, the feathers that make the sound, they're a little bit stiffer than the female's feathers, and they've got a different shape. And the shape is very closely related to the sounds they produce. And so males will do this display and females won't. At the same time, though, so it's August right now. It's not the breeding season. I heard a male diving just the other day. And most of the Anna's hummingbirds are molting right now. So this must have been a male that had finished molting his tail feathers. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, a guy just bought a sports car and wants to go drive around the block a bit, even though he's not on a date. And so he's just out trying it out. You will see males displaying to other males. They also, I mean, I've had them dive to me, or if you can see them sometimes diving to other species of bird, like song sparrows or house finches. And so it's possible that this dive is multifunctional and that they're also using it to try to intimidate other males or just in general to say, here I am, this is my territory. So it's possible that it's used for more than just courtship, but it is most definitely a courtship signal, because if you take a female Anna's hummingbird and put her on a male's territory, he will come over and dive to her over and over and over again. And the part of this that we haven't been able to study, and so we don't really know what's going on, is what about the dive do the females actually like or actually prefer? Like, we know that something about the dive is what they like, because if we look at different species, closely related species, the dive will be very different. And the fact that it's different implies that female preferences have pushed the displays that the males do in different directions. But if we could actually get inside a female's brain and study more what it is that she likes about the display, we would have more, we'd be able to better understand exactly what's going on. And unfortunately, in hummingbirds, studying their mating choices has been really tough. There are other bird species like sage grouse, where you can sit on a lek and watch which males the females choose to mate with. And with hummingbirds, what happens is that a female comes onto a male's territory, you watch them display a whole bunch, then they fly out of sight. And then 30 seconds later, the male comes back by himself. And it's like, well, did they just mate, or did she fly away and, you know, flee? You didn't see what happened. So we don't actually know which males the females like and which ones they don't.
Ooh, the mysteries of hummingbird courtship.
Yes.
Okay. And of course, they really like to, I call it bicker. They do a lot of aerial dogfighting and bickering, chasing each other around. Is that just about trying to chase them off of, you know, these are my flowers or my feeder? What's going on there?
Yeah. So I mentioned a while ago, I mentioned sunbirds, these birds in Africa. Sunbirds are very similar, where they are very aggressive around other sunbirds, and they will try to set up territories guarding flowers. So something about flowers and feeding from flowers makes the birds that do it also get really aggressive. And it, I think what it comes down to is that flowers are trying to be seen. Flowers are trying to be observed by their pollinators. And so it's really easy for a hummingbird to look out over its territory and know what its territory is worth, like how many flowers it has. But it's also really easy for an intruder to see the flowers and to say, hey, that's a really good territory, I should try to take it over. And so basically, it seems to me that feeding on flowers, feeding on this really visible food source, has produced birds that then try to be really territorial and try to be really aggressive with each other. And when it comes to a hummingbird feeder, this is not actually necessarily advantageous for the birds. So a typical hummingbird feeder, you know, assuming it hasn't run dry, it's basically an infinite flower with an infinite amount of food. But the birds are acting like the feeder is going to run out of food really soon, and they need to guard it against the other birds. Because a typical flower, you know, like a small flower might have 2 microliters of nectar, a really large flower might have 100 microliters of nectar. In either case, the hummingbird can drink all of that nectar and want more. And so the fact they're so aggressive to each other around feeders is just a holdover that that's their natural behaviors, to be aggressive around flowers.
Ah, yeah, I see. Because like I look at them and, you know, sometimes I talk to them. I know they don't understand me. Mostly, hey, there's plenty there. You can go to the other side of the feeder. You can both. But nope, they chase each other off. And it's especially interesting. I noticed the rufous hummingbirds are very aggressive about, you know, hey, my feeder right now, you stay away.
Yeah, the rufous, at least in North America, the rufous tend to be dominant over most other bird species. There's a couple of exceptions to that. One is that they are good at low elevation, but as you go up in elevation, the broad-tailed hummingbirds, which are kind of our high elevation specialist in the United States, the broad-tailed hummingbirds at high elevation can kick the butt of the rufous hummingbirds. And that's basically that broad-tails are better at flying in thin air. And rufous have pretty small wings, which means that they do better when the air is denser at lower elevations. And then the other thing that happens is that, of course, rufous hummingbirds spend half the year in Mexico. And in Mexico, they are pretty small. There's a bunch of large species of hummingbird, much bigger than rufous. And so the rufous hummingbirds are not behaviorally dominant on the wintering grounds in Mexico. Oh, and a third effect is that they molt. They drop their feathers when they're in Mexico. And one of the things about molting is that it compromises their ability to fly. So what hummingbirds do is they will drop first kind of their inner primary feathers, and then one by one they drop their feathers, marching their way out towards the outer edge of their wing. And so when they're missing, and then when they're regrowing those outer wing feathers, that's when their flight performance is compromised the most. And so a hummingbird might be really aggressive at other times, but when it's molting its feathers, this is it's vulnerable, and there's not much that it can do. It's not able to outfly its competitors. So the interesting thing about rufous is that when they're in Mexico, they are not the dominant hummingbird species around. That's a specifically thing that you see in rufous when they're migrating in California and other parts of the West.
Okay, before we let you go, what are some of the main conservation issues facing hummingbirds?
Oh, conservation. Yeah, so many hummingbird species are doing fine, but not all of them. And right now, climate change is a big concern, but it actually is not the main driver of hummingbird extinction right now. The biggest driver of extinction is habitat loss. So just like with pretty much every other species on the planet, some hummingbirds are generalists and can handle lots of different habitats, but other hummingbirds are habitat specialists. And so in the tropics, deforestation and other things like that tend to be the biggest biggest reason why hummingbird populations are imperiled or almost extinct. Another one is that in some places, hummingbird species are changing their ranges, and this change in range is impinging on a species that's endangered. So one of my favorite species in Chile is the Chilean woodstar. This is a critically endangered hummingbird species, and that's apparently because another hummingbird, the Peruvian sheartail, is expanding its range. And as they expand their range, they are outcompeting or otherwise affecting the Chilean woodstar. And the Chilean woodstar has also been really hurt by habitat loss. You know, when you go to the grocery store and there's tomatoes in the off season and they say grown in Chile, well, they were grown in land that used to have Chilean woodstars on it and now has tomato farms.
Thanks so much for spending this time with us, Chris. It's just, it's an amazing topic. We could talk about it for hours. I could. But I know people love hummingbirds, and I hope they enjoyed hearing from you about the amazing secret lives of hummingbirds.
Thank you. Well, yeah, my pleasure. As you mentioned, this is a topic I can talk about for hours.
Thanks again to our guest, Associate Professor in the Department of Evolution, Ecology, and Organismal Biology and Principal Investigator for the Animal Aeroacoustics Lab at UC Riverside. You can check out their work at animalaeroacoustics.ucr.edu. And on a personal note, if you decide to use a backyard hummingbird feeder, please make sure you clean it regularly, keep it filled, and if you can, add lots of flowering plants that appeal to local pollinators in your yard. The hummingbirds that visit your yard will thrive and give you hours of fascination. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.